and welcome to a special meeting of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. This is an additional meeting because we do have a lot in our docket, and we're trying to make sure we get done in time and not hear additional hearings. So I think folks know that we have a lot on our agenda today and a lot of folks who want to testify, so we'll make sure and try to go through as best we can. We are going to do a different order, so I'm just going to let folks know we're going to hear House Bill 2999 first, then House Bill 3463, 3123, 2761, 3417 will be last, and then the work session on 2080. With that, I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2999A.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2999A, for the record, there's no revenue impact and there was a fiscal statement issued. It changes requirement for information on location of pesticide use from identification of third-level hydrologic unit to fourth-level hydrologic unit. Extends the sunset to January 2nd, 2016, and prohibits ODA from expending monies or department resources for purposes of operating or maintaining a pesticide use reporting system from October 1st, 2009 until June 30th, 2011. And it declares an emergency as an effective upon passage.
Okay, thank you. And I, Representative Clem? There you are. I was like, where'd it go? It just left him. Come on up.
Your phone was too.
Oh, no. I kind of miss him.
Come on, B-squared. I'm going to vote no just for you.
Thank you very much. It's a good start. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I'm Brian Clem, State Rep from here in Salem, District 21. And I just wanted to really briefly, because I know you're
well, we're missing a few folks, so
I'll still go
they'll
briefly.
Be here soon. Yeah.
House Bill 2999 represents a lot of work in the interim to bring parties together to figure out how to move forward on changes to the pesticide use reporting system that all kind of user groups and advocates could feel good about. And I think there's one more amendment that now is here that kind of deals with the fact that it's going to be mothballed for the next 2 years. So the sunset period would be extended by 2 years to deal with the fact that it's mothballed, but there's also an agreement that nobody's going to come in and try and change this program until that sunset date is reached. And I think that needs to be in writing. I believe it is from the relevant parties, Oregon Ranger Food and Shelter and NCAP. And that's my understanding of that amendment. With that, I'd be supportive, but just moves the reporting threshold from the water basin to the watershed and renews the sunset, and puts in some amendments that help ODOT, essentially, when they spray in long straight lines, be able to record that accurately for the purposes the program was designed to do.
Okay. And the amendment, I know we have somebody here who wants to speak to the amendment.
I think so, but
is
he's
Chris,
not.
Chris Pardo's not here. So why don't you, do you have the proposed amendment?
You know, I actually don't.
I think Beth is going to give it to you so you can just tell us what exactly it does. I'm assuming it's just on.
I think it just moves the sunset to two more years out, Madam Chair, but let me just take a look. Yeah, the amendment just moves the sunset date out for the basically the duration of the mothball period, which is this biennium, so then it extends the sunset date out two more years.
So on page 3, line 24, you're talking about change 2016 to 2018?
I should do math slightly better. It's, I think, 2.5 years because we end on June 30th, so it goes to 2019.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. committee members, Amay Code is also here to speak to the amendment.
Okay. Okay. Any questions for the representative before we... And actually, you're going to speak on the next bill, too, so you may want to hang out.
Okay.
No? Okay, well, why don't we have Amay come up, then? May Code.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Amay Code with the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides. Just want to thank Representative Clem and everyone who has moved this forward. We're at dash 7 amendments now, and my testimony does, I didn't know the dash number, and we are supportive of the dash 7 amendments.
Okay.
I could briefly speak to the benefits of pesticide use reporting and some of the agencies that would help if that would be appropriate at this time?
I don't necessarily know if that's necessary. We're pretty familiar with the
some
program
of us
unless
have lived
you would
this
like
for
to.
Three sessions.
Yeah. Okay.
Only
you.
Three? I think some have been with it for more.
We don't have the amendment yet, right?
We do have the amendment. We do not have a fiscal or revenue on the
okay.
yet.
Okay. Can you have handed that out to folks?
Yes, it's in your packet, and it's also in the back of the room.
Okay, because I didn't see it in there, but maybe
I need to wait for the fiscal.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Okay, we have some other folks that would like to add their comments. Terry Witt, Katie Fast, and Andrea Salinas. We can adopt the amendment today, though, and then the fiscal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators on the committee. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We were part of the drafting of the PERS bill back in 1999 and also served on the work group that put together the kind of the recommended rule package. Just a few very, very brief comments. Number one, we have always supported, and I'll throw in a we being OFS and Farm Bureau, having reporting done by watershed. We felt that matches up best with the other regulations that we have in the state, including watershed councils. And so we do support moving from water basin to watershed on non-urban reporting locations, and we are also in agreement with the A7 amendments. Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides came to us, asked us if we would be willing to discuss pushing that sunset out another 3 years in light of the fact that the program will now be basically shelved for 3 years, giving us only 2.5 or 3 years worth of data, which we feel would be probably incomplete in terms of giving us the ability to do a thorough assessment of the value and the effectiveness of the reporting process. So we, our only concern was that we don't continue to come back session after session and make changes to the bill. Let's leave it the same so that we can compare apples to apples, and they were in agreement to do that. And so we said as long as we can put that in writing that the major agricultural folks, namely Farm Bureau and OFS, along with the major environmental organizations, NCAP and Oregon Environmental Council, would agree that we would not push for any changes to the statute until that sunset expired. And so with that, we are supportive of not only the bill, but the A7 amendments.
Okay.
For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll keep my comments brief. I should be receiving the memorandum next week from the four groups with those constraints around the legislation. I'd just like to say appreciative to Oregon Department of Agriculture and Representative Klim on working through this issue and addressing the fiscal on the program for this biennium, because it is important from the user community that as the program moves forward, there is that commitment, that general fund and also registration fees move fund the program 50-50. And so pulling it back this year during the economic downturn allows that partnership to continue in the future.
And maybe I'll ask this to the department, but was there discussion about the need to sort of retool the system, obviously, because we're changing the reporting requirements? In the discussion, and I'll probably have the department come up and address that too.
I think they probably would be best, but I think you're correct, Chair Dingfelder, that there will be some minor retooling that will be necessary, both because of switching from water basin to watershed and also to accommodate the what we call linear applications, which would be along rights of ways. Currently, the system is not set up to do that, so they will have to do something that translates linear, either milepost or GPS location, into some sort of amount of pesticides used.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Andrea?
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the legislative director with the Oregon Environmental Council. And as Mr. Witt described, we do agree with the A7 amendments and the agreement between the four groups. We believe that extension of the PERS sunset until 2019 is important for a number of reasons. Additional time is critical to evaluating whether the current methods are the most effective ways to collect the data. This includes having enough time for pesticide users to understand how to use the system and for the Department of Ag to ensure participation is high enough to provide accurate representative data. Ensuring at least 5 years of PERS reporting will allow more time to show and more accurately understand trends in pesticide use. And for these reasons, OEC urges you to support HB 2999 and to extend it to 2019.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. Is there any questions? Okay, thank you for coming up. And last, we have Jim Welsh. And would anybody else like to testify? Actually, I'll ask the department to come up as well. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, Jim Welsh with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. And also, I can add in the Oregon State Grange on this. They're very supportive. We've talked to Oregonians for Food and Shelter and Oregon Farm Bureau. They are the experts, and they worked on the work group and on the bill, and we are in support. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Ag, and with me is Chris Kirby, the Administrator of our Pesticides Division, who has had the opportunity to implement the pesticide use reporting system over time. I did not come prepared with any comments today. We are providing you some maps that we had on hand that would show the difference in reporting scale from the third field hydrological unit to the fourth field hydrological unit. Those were also provided to the House Ag and Natural Resource Committee when the bill was heard on the House side.
I guess in response to my other question, and Mr. Kirby, you're probably better equipped to explain this. So are you going to need to make some wholesale changes to the system? I know we're sort of not going to be implementing it for several years, but in the meantime, you'll be working on getting the word out to folks the different level of reporting. Can you talk about what the department's going to be doing and making sure that this change happens smoothly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The way the bill is worded, excuse me, Madam Chair. It's Friday.
Do we know that?
Madam Chair, excuse me. The bill does cause us to
I'd be called worse things. So.
The bill does cause us to make some changes to the system. There would be a fiscal impact with that. However, the bill also states that we would not be operating the system during the coming biennium, and time is built into the bill for us to enact these minor changes to the system, not in the 09-11 biennium, but in the 11-13 biennium. So our fiscal impact that we have prepared regarding this bill without the -7 amendment is zero, and we do not foresee that the change proposed by the -7 amendments would change that fiscal impact.
Okay. However, we still will need a new fiscal statement. Yes, Senator Voglis.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I would expect any fiscal to come back to say minimal, if almost nothing. The present reporting system, and the department can correct me, it's check the block, and now we're going to add additional blocks that you're going to check. And then if you read the verbiage of the bill, they're going to be able to identify in the text of that's submitted the right-of-way in which the department there would be able to check the blocks if they didn't understand what block. So in theory, you could check two blocks if you were a farmer or a right-of-way person, and so I don't see the programming changes, because it's pretty simple right now, frankly. I mean, you just click the box where you're at and move on.
Well, it's good to hear from a user that they're user-friendly.
For once.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else that you'd like to add on this? Any other questions for the department? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Jim. Anybody else like to testify on this bill? Okay, with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2999A, and I will open up a work session for the purposes of just adopting the amendment. Then we'll need to get the fiscal on that. So with that, I'll open up work session on House Bill 2999A, and would take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the dash?
A7.
A7 into the bill.
Carried over.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Atkinson has made a motion to adopt the A7s into House Bill 2999. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay, seeing none, the amendment is adopted and Senator Brzezinski is excused, and we will carry the work session over until next Tuesday. You think we'll have the paperwork by then, hopefully, and then we can move it next Tuesday. That will close the work session on House Bill 2999A. We'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3463A as well.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3463A requires notice to dealers when capacity of biodiesel production facilities in Oregon reaches certain levels, prohibits sale of diesel fuel that does not contain specified percentages of biodiesel after a certain date.
Okay, any representative? A few representatives.
Yes.
Who would like to speak on this?
Clem.
Okay, so Representative Clem, Representative Bailey, and is Representative Jensen here? Do you know if anybody called his office?
Natalie did call.
Okay. So. Well, why don't we go ahead and get started, and if Representative Jensen, and then we have Department of Ag. Is Russ here somewhere? Okay. He's hiding in the back. Okay, welcome, gentlemen. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Copel-Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42 in Inner East Side, Portland. House Bill 3463 comes before you today from your House Environment and Water Committee. It is a result of a process of negotiations to align the requirements for biodiesel with in the RFS with the ethanol standards, and to allow for Oregon biodiesel production to effectively come to market. This bill, the proponents of this bill will go through it, the specifics in more detail, but in essence what this bill does is allows for as of August 1st in specified counties, mostly within the Willamette Valley and the metro area and over to the coast, for biodiesel production from in-state that's at capacity to be blended into the existing diesel sales, and for production, and then in October 1st for the rest of the state. The other major thing that the bill does is to impose essentially a two-year moratorium on what is known as renewable diesel, which is an emerging diesel technology that is produced outside of Oregon. I'd like to be able to report to you today that House Bill 3463 had a unanimous support of the stakeholders. I think you will hear from those involved that it at this point does not. However, we felt that in the negotiations we got the bill as close to a compromise bill as we were able to get. I believe there's broad consensus on the dates of implementation for the bill. However, there is still some disagreement about the renewable diesel component of the bill. Representative Jensen and myself, in consultation with the proponents and opponents of the bill, got to a place where we felt that a two-year moratorium on renewable diesel was an acceptable compromise. This is a technology that is still emerging and is not yet sold in Oregon. And in rather than the original bill, 3463, removed renewable diesel completely from consideration for the renewable fuel standard. What we did was put it back in, but with a two-year moratorium to allow for Oregon industries to ramp up, to get a place in the market, and then after 2 years to take a look at how that technology is faring outside of Oregon and whether or not it makes sense to integrate it into Oregon's fuel supply. So that's where we came to with this bill, and it comes to you with bipartisan support from your House. And with that, I'll turn over to Representative Clem.
Representative Clem, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Clem, State Representative, District 21. My testimony is going to be extremely brief. Representatives Bailey and Jensen did all the work. I have a large biodiesel facility here in Salem that had requested I get involved with this bill. And to be candid, that involved putting my name on it, watching Representative Jensen and Bailey do all the work, and then voting for it.
I'm assuming you're here because you're supportive of the bill and like to see it move forward.
And you called me up. I'm here on another bill. Oh. But since you
okay,
we had
you down here. Are you here on all these bills today? Okay. I know your name was on the bill as a chief co-sponsor as well. So I figured you were here for this. So any questions for either of these representatives? Senator Atkinson.
A couple questions. So the purpose of the bill is to get more technology into Oregon, but yet going to ban renewable diesel. I don't know. That seems counterintuitive to me.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, if I may, House Bill 3463 does not ban renewable diesel. It imposes a timeout on renewable diesel because it is a technology that is still emerging, is not yet made in Oregon, and that was a place where we felt that the emergence of Oregon jobs and Oregon industries, that it was important to allow them to be able to compete in the marketplace. At this point, unless something has changed in the last couple of weeks since we took testimony in the House committee, there is not currently renewable diesel being sold in Oregon. And so this does not remove any product from the marketplace that the consumers are relying on. Rather, it allows for an Oregon industry to get off the ground. They have full tanks. It allows them to get those tanks into the marketplace without restricting consumer choice on a technology that isn't yet commercially available.
Don't we get into a commerce cause problem with that, where one state banning a product from another state, because that ban moratorium isn't in effect in Washington or in California, I don't believe. And so don't we have a commerce cause or commerce clause problem?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I'm not an attorney, but defer to legal experts on the Commerce Clause. However, my understanding of that provision would be that because we are excluding renewable diesel no matter where it is manufactured, it happens to not be manufactured in Oregon, but it is a different product from biodiesel. So we are not saying that products made out of state are excluded while products made in-state are included. They're two different products, and the renewable diesel, if it was made in Oregon, would also have the moratorium imposed on it, just like renewable diesel outside of Oregon.
Okay. And I'll have the department come up, and they can respond to that, too. Senator Boquist.
That's right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the House testimony, what we're talking about is developing a product and then blending. We don't have any oil wells that I'm aware of in the state of Oregon. So in the testimony on renewable diesel and technologies that haven't come to Oregon yet, give me an explanation what renewable diesel in theory is.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I would defer to the representatives from the petroleum industry to give you a technical description of renewable diesel. My understanding is that it uses a different process of incorporating biological material into petroleum to create a product that is different from biodiesel. But I'm not an expert in the chemistry of those products.
Thank you.
We'll have some folks come up here and explain it because I had the same question.
Okay.
Representative? Yeah.
Just to respond to Senator Atkinson's point. I think actually he's on to something there with the Interstate Commerce Clause. But I think what we would hear from legislative counsel is that it's not a ban on production, it's not a ban on sale, it's a moratorium on that product being counted towards our renewable standard. So it could still be sold here. It just doesn't count towards the standard. And I think it would be if you were actually trying to limit the sale of it somehow, you would definitely have violated the Interstate Commerce Clause, no doubt about it.
Okay. Well,
I would guess. That's just my.
We'll have the Department of Ag come up because I know that they will I'm sure they'll be able to. They're hiding. So we'll see if they can answer it. All right. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming over. So we will have the Department of Agriculture up here and Department of Energy before we hear from other folks. And I know the folks from all these folks are having deja vu from last session, my committee. We had hours and hours of testimony.
I thought I was going to get around this being on Ag and Natural Resources.
Yeah, that too. So who would like to go first? Maybe, Russ, do you want to, whoever would like to speak first to the renewable diesel when it comes to definition, I think that would be helpful.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder. For the record, Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We really didn't come prepared to talk about 3463A with specific comments.
Came prepared for
with specific comments,
got
but
it,
I think we can
it.
Answer your question about the other renewable. We have not consulted our legal counsel, certainly, about whether it violates a commerce clause. I think the understanding, though, of what Representative Klim were here is that it doesn't prohibit it. It just does not count towards the production in the state. And Russ's work through this bill, for the most part, I have with me Russ Wyckoff, who is our administrator with our Weights and Measures Division. We do have some comments we want to make to the bill regarding the timing of the notice when it goes out, and so when that's appropriate, Chair,
okay.
We'd like to make comments on that.
So why don't you respond to that, and then you can go ahead and make comments on the
Thank
timing.
You, Chair Dingfelder. Russ Wyckoff again with Measurement Standards Division, Department of Agriculture. As Representative Klim stated, the requirement there for the B2 requirement would require it to be biodiesel to meet that requirement. It would not prohibit renewable diesel from being used. So you could have B2 to meet that requirement and still have 5 or 10% renewable diesel also in the product. So you're not eliminating that product from being sold during that moratorium. You're only saying it doesn't count towards the trigger for the renewable fuel requirement. So the one thing that we wanted to point out is on the A and gross version, when we reviewed this bill with the idea of we would be making the administrative rules to enforce it, we did notice a conflict in the time. If you'd look at the bill, the original time, it's online. This is the A and gross version. Find where I'm at here.
Yeah.
Okay, it's on 646922. 921 says that on August 1st, nine counties would be required to do the B2 requirement. And then that section 2A says, or 2B says, that the rest of the state comes on board on October 1st. And on the second page of that bill, on line 22, it states that upon receipt of the notice, all retail dealers, non-retail dealers, and wholesale dealers would be required to sell B2. Well, that's physically impossible. First of all, that means that if I have a 10,000-gallon tank of diesel in the ground and we notify the 1,600 dealers that deal in this, they open the envelope and it says, now I can only sell B2. I can't do that. I have a storage tank full of regular diesel.
So why was it, it originally said 3 months after the date?
That was taken out from the original 2210 and,
right,
and changed in the original version of this. We didn't take that out and change it. But when we noted that you were saying on August 1st and October 1st, these timelines happened, yet upon receipt of the notice, you immediately had to do it. We requested an amendment that said upon receipt of the notice, under ORS 646-9212, and after the dates, that's what the amendment is. On the amendment, it's not in bold, but it now reads, upon receipt of the notice and after the date specified in ORS 646-9212 2A and 2B. So what we're saying is, we're going to mail you the notice, we're going to tell you you need to do it, now you need to go back to section 2A and 2B to determine when that time frame is for you as a retail dealer. That allows you to get rid of the product that you have in the storage tank and begin resupplying with the B2 to meet that requirement.
Okay, so this is the A8, which I think everybody
yes.
should have.
Also available on the back of the room.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Graney, why don't you go ahead and then we'll take questions.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. Just want to express very briefly our support for House Bill 3463 and just mention policy-wise the importance of this. It is a correction to the biofuels package that passed last session, House Bill 2210. And when we worked on the targets for activating the renewable fuel standard for both ethanol and biodiesel, the primary concern was to assure that there would be adequate product in state for both commodities when the renewable fuel standard kicked in. So we didn't have a situation where there's a mandate, but not necessarily fuel available. And, of course, fuel gets sold between states, but we wanted to make sure that there was adequate supply of both fuels when the targets became law and became a requirement. In drafting them up, frankly, we weren't sure the best way to assure that. One was written as capacity. Ethanol was. This one was based on actual production. In retrospect, the capacity one was more effective in helping to create the market and assuring that biofuel was used. And that's the reason for our support for changing the RFS target to capacity as well. Let me just mention that on the renewable fuel, I think the renewable biodiesel, I think the approach in the Angros bill is a reasonable compromise. On the other hand, I think whatever you do on renewable biofuel, it's more important to change the target for biodiesel to be based on capacity, whether you include or defer the active date on renewable biodiesel.
Okay. Questions? Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 5 of the bill, it defines other renewable diesel as a diesel fuel substitute produced by non-fossil renewable resources as established by ASTM and approved by the EPA to meet specifications, which seems pretty simple. It's a federal law that approves this product, and I'm assuming this product must exist in some other states. And then elsewhere in the bill, I continue to see may not sell or offer for sale and may not sell or offer for sale. Is it the department's, both departments' position that if somebody has this product that's approved by the federal government, it will still be legal to sell in the state of Oregon upon passage of this bill?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, the intent there from Measurement Standards Division as far as page 5, the other renewable diesel means, what we're looking for there, because it is a new product, it isn't accepted. At this point, it's been done in Europe. It's all new technology in the United States. We wanted to ensure in the original House Bill 2210 that before it was going to be sold, it had to meet these tests. It has to be approved by ASTM, by EPA, by the National Conference of Weights and Measures. That would give us an ASTM test that we could subject this product to make sure it made the quality standards, that we could ensure the consumers were getting a quality product before we allowed that to be sold in Oregon.
And the second half of the question?
Follow-up.
Got that portion.
Okay.
So let's use a hypothetical. We'll say Conoco, 3 months from now, receives approval from the federal government to sell other renewable diesel. Can they sell 4 months from now renewable diesel in the state of Oregon?
Then we would go back to ConocoPhillips and ask them to make sure that we have to have an ASTM standard. It's not EPA can approve something, but until we have an ASTM standard, we don't have anything to test it against for the quality. So we're going to ask them to do all three of these things prior to being sold in Oregon.
Okay, so now 5 months from now, we have everything done, the federal government, ASTM sends, this is good to go in the state of Idaho. Can they sell it in the state of Washington 5 months from now if they get all these approvals?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator, what you mean in the state of Oregon?
Yes.
Okay. If they meet all these approvals, then yes, we would go back to rule and we would allow them to sell that product in Oregon as long as it wasn't at this period of time being used to meet the B2 requirement, which I believe is what is being eliminated for in one of these versions.
Okay. I got it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson.
Two questions. And along those lines, it seems to me that by this banning or moratorium, even though they can sell, but it doesn't count, it seems like we're picking winners and losers here. Am I missing something? Because when we pick winners and losers, the winners do whoever's making biodiesel is doing just fine, but the consumers aren't necessarily getting all the options. And it's a policy of the state of Oregon to encourage as many renewable products and projects and types of green energy as possible. And by that moratorium, it appears that we're picking winners and losers.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Atkinson, if I get your question, I think those were policy decisions that originally started with 2210, and I think the other portion has been in and out as part of those discussions, and certainly those policy were to create that incentive in Oregon.
Yeah, I can somewhat address that, Senator. The House Bill 2210, the intent was to provide incentives for Oregon-grown feedstock. And so my sense is with this bill is it's trying to be consistent with those policies. That was the concern that was brought to my understanding, or brought to my attention, and was my understanding that why this bill is being promoted. Is that correct, gentlemen?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Right. I think we're going to hear some other testimony as well, so thank you.
Thanks.
Gavin Carpenter. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And Brian Dougherty.
Madam Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Atkinson, my name is Gavin Carpenter. I'm the sales manager with Sequential Pacific Biodiesel. We have the biodiesel plant just down the road. I'm here to talk a little bit about renewable diesel. Initially, when this bill came forward, we supported it with removing the renewable diesel component. Following Representative Bailey's lead, we agreed to the two-year moratorium on it. We have some serious concerns about renewable diesel. Our main concern is we just would like a level playing field. In order to trigger the statewide RFS, we built a new plant of 5 million gallons per year for biodiesel. There's no condition in there for renewable diesel at all. A little thing about renewable diesel, basically, it's made from animal tallow or vegetable oil, and it's processed at an oil refinery. It's processed with crude oil. The way it'll be worked here, if renewable diesel is allowed in the statewide RFS, is it'll be processed in Anacortes, Washington, and shot down the pipeline. Not $1, not one job is going to be created in the state because of this if they're allowed to use renewable diesel. There's no renewable diesel plants, not just in Oregon. There's not a renewable diesel plant in the U.S. It's a very new technology. We're not opposed to renewable diesel. We're open to it. We just ask that they be held to the same standards that we're being held to, which is to put some money in the state of Oregon, build a renewable diesel plant, and play ball with the rest of us. So I'm open to any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Nevin. Brian.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brian Dougherty representing the Western States Petroleum Association. I brought to you some testimony that has both some legal analysis of the Commerce Clause as well as some comments regarding renewable diesel. As you've heard, in 2007, as part of the ethanol and biodiesel mandates that you passed in House Bill 2010, we had a renewable diesel definition. It's been in here for 2 years. The state of Washington just unanimously passed a bill this year that unanimously approved the renewable diesel definition. The governor signed it. The EPA has recognized it. The IRS has recognized it. The Energy Security Act has it in it. It meets ASTM. There's the definitions that are in there have been made. What it hasn't been produced in the Northwest. But I'd like to correct something. Renewable diesel is simply a different process of taking the same type of crops, oils, greases, or bone tallow that are non-fossil fuel, which is what you've been trying to do, and processes it at the diesel, at the refinery, as opposed to how a biodiesel refiner does it at their biodiesel refinery and then blends it at the oil terminal as a B100 product. We're not B100. For renewable diesel, but it is using the same crops and products. It can do that. It can help benefit Oregon farmers and ranchers and feedstocks. It is not simply bone tallow is the only way that you can use this. So it has that opportunity. I have with you, and I believe are in your packets, are the Dash 9 amendments that we have prepared. The A9 amendments are simply returning the renewable diesel to the bill, but including the parts that were the serious issues that I understood the biodiesel industry had. They wanted to get the B2 capacity, get B2 on the books in Oregon now. We agreed to do that and do it on an August 1st, 2009, October 1st timeline, which is costing us hundreds of thousands of dollars to do because you have to put in injection equipment, you have to have tankage, you need to find out the logistics of getting this to eastern Oregon and down to southern Oregon. So we're fine with that. We're neutral on this bill if you put renewable diesel. I have not heard a good argument yet as to why you need to take out renewable diesel when it's never been a competitor. It is not the issue that they're fighting. Midwest soy is what the issue is. It's not renewable diesel. We haven't been there. Their competitor is Midwest soy, just like ethanol. King and ethanol is Midwest corn. You know, that hasn't had a great track record. Let me talk to you a little bit about the legal issue. I believe you are effectively keeping us out of this market to meet this B2 standard. You have now warranties that aren't allowed, that only accept up to B5. If you have either in effect or purpose the bid to try and protect in-state industry from out-of-state products, which ours are because they would be manufactured at a refinery, and the refineries are up in Washington or in Utah that supply Oregon. You need to look no further than the floor speech at the House that just said, it simply says time out on technology that's not available in Oregon, and it ensures that large out-of-state petroleum interests don't come in and squash Oregon industry before it has a chance to get off the ground. That's about as clear a Commerce Clause statement as you can get. And that's what I've heard every time. So I've asked counsel in the back of my packet is some of the issues on that. That shows purpose to protect an in-state industry. The effect is similar here too. If even though your purpose isn't that, if the effect is to protect in-state industry from out-of-state competition, it's a Commerce Clause violation. Even if it's not, I still say that this is a technology that you have encouraged and has been encouraged all over the nation. We're needing to blend 22 billion gallons of other second-generation biofuels and 16 billion gallons of ethanol in the next few years. And here we have our abilities and our investments to try and find answers. So we have a different way to do it than B100. Why in the world would we limit this? We're not even here. There's no evidence, and I know of no plans immediately to bring this in, but I think we are taking a dangerous step if we're going to go backwards, withdraw something that's been here for 2 years without any competitive effect, and disallow someone from coming in and operating this if it becomes an effective product. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Well, actually, I think you can provide comments offline because I'm not really going to want to have a point counterpoint, but let's see if there's some questions first. Senator Przanski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, question, I guess, about the renewable diesel mix. How long has it been in production? What, if any, research has been done as to its effectiveness in comparison to other products that we're talking about that are currently being done here in the state?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Przanski, the renewable diesel has been used by companies in Australia and Europe. It has been used by ConocoPhillips in Texas. It is determined that it is viable as a product. They have elected not to go forward with it, I think for a number of reasons that they haven't shared with me, but it is a product that has been tested and found to be a viable product.
Follow up. I wonder if you can get us the information as to what this test is. What, you know, if I can get something that talks about what tests have been done, the efficiency, whether it's, you know, we're going through this issue here in the state regarding ethanol, and so it's one of those things that maybe I would like to have a little bit more comfort as to what we're looking at before we start down the path that may find out that it may have unintended consequences. And it doesn't sound like, from what I'm hearing, that it's actually being manufactured or used in the country at this point. So it seems very new, and I'm not sure how long any other countries have been using it or what its applications have actually shown as to its efficiency and effectiveness. And I guess that's that, and if I could follow up.
Yeah.
And based on what I just heard, Ryan, that they've tried it in Texas in the sense of developing it, but they've chosen not to go forward. I would like to know what is their business decision for not going forward. I mean, if you're going through the research and all that, why is it they're not moving forward, and what is the expectations in the future?
Chair Dingo, or Senator Przanski, my understanding is it has not become commercially available because of cost issues, getting it more competitive in the market. It is not science-based. I understand there is an ASTM standard for it now. I'll be happy to get you the information as it's qualified by the EPA and others and get you some of the efficiencies and what its profile looks like.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for these witnesses?
Thank you.
Okay. And we'll look forward to getting that follow-up information, Brian. Thank you. Thank you, both of you. Anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 3463?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. I'm Alex Kyler, for the record, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and I'm just provided some quick testimony for you here in that Lane County, back in 2005, started working with Sequential Biofuels to site their first retail station for biofuels distribution, and the county's economic development program worked to foreclose on a facility that was highly contaminated. We took on the liability of owning that facility, applying for a grant from EPA to retrofit and to clean it up and monitor it, and then turn that site over to Sequential. They've successfully operated their retail station right adjacent to I-5 there, and we've had a very successful partnership with Sequential as a result. It's a company that was formed down in Lane County. They've done a substantial investment in Marion County and were involved with the 2007 Renewable Fuel Standard. The Board of County Commissioners has examined this bill. They're in support of it in terms of its impact to Oregon agriculture, and would urge a yes vote.
Thank you. Any questions for Alex? All right. Thank you. Okay. So with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3463A and look forward to getting that follow-up information. Okay. We'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on 2761, House Bill 2761. Beth?
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2761 establishes that a landowner that needs more information to determine whether their land qualifies as agricultural land may request Department of Land Conservation and Development to arrange for a certified professional soil classifier to assess the capability of the soil.
Okay, and do we have somebody from the department or who would like to?
Clem.
Okay, Representative Clem, we're back. This must be the bills coming over from the Ag Committee.
They are, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to testify on House Bill 2761. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from here in Salem, Chair of the House Ag Committee. This bill came unanimously out of committee and unanimously across the House floor. Helps clean up the process a little bit for determining when. And, oh, actually, could I ask Mr. Cleave to join me?
Sure. And he's representing?
Oregon Farm Bureau.
Okay.
Basically cleans up the process for if somebody feels that a soil science classification that's in the NRCS database isn't valid and they want to request a second opinion, this describes how that would occur. And so people would contact the Department of Land Conservation Development, where a registry is maintained of people in good standing and soil classifications, and then they would arrange for somebody to provide that second opinion for the landowner to try and get them a different result if they didn't like the first one.
Okay, so we have dueling soil scientists.
Try to avoid that is the goal.
I was going to say, so how often does this happen?
I think you could ask, thank you, sorry, Madam Chair, about 100 a year, it sounds like, potentially where the total cases, mm-hmm. and then when they're in dispute, I'm not sure, but the department could talk to you more about that.
Okay. Do you want to say anything,
Sean? Madam Chair, for the record, Sean Cleave representing Oregon Farm Bureau. The Oregon Farm Bureau supports the bill. We have had a variety of conflicts, or whether real or perceived, and regarding the classification of soils, this deal specifically deals with a conflict of interest when you're paying for those specific soil scientists to come out and almost give you the answer you are looking for. So we support the bill because we feel that this might provide a buffer between that conflict of interest and the analysis.
Okay. Thanks. Any questions? I think Senator Roquist, you had one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Anybody want to comment on the $800,000 fiscal for 200 tests?
Why didn't it go to Ways and Means if it has a...
Madam Chair, I think you have a subsequent referral on your side, which I found odd, actually, because I didn't know the fiscal, but we didn't have one. So then when I saw there was one on there, you know, it's up to Senate President or whoever assigns that. I understand that. It's essentially to represent Senator Boquist. Now, I'm sorry, B Square. It's a cost recovery mechanism. These are dollars that would be spent by the applicant to hire a soil scientist anyway. This is just a cost recovery mechanism so the taxpayers don't subsidize the activity.
Okay. I see those other funds, but yeah. We've been sending everything, whether it's other funds or not, down to Ways and Means, so that's probably why. Okay. Any other questions, Senator Atkinson?
Does the registry break it down by region?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, the registry is more about the qualifications of the individual. So are they a member in good standing of certain accreditation organizations or soil classification organizations?
Yeah.
So no regional variance, just are they a member of this particular soil scientist in good standing type of deal? Senator Dingfelder.
Okay. It's Friday. I've been called lots of other things today, too.
I may be reading a little bit into your question, but to respond from the Farm Bureau's perspective, there wouldn't necessarily need to be a regional breakdown. Obviously, our land use system does provide for some regional differences, specifically Willamette Valley and versus the rest of the state, but those same standards would apply throughout the state.
Follow up.
Will the registry and the people who are in good standing, would you be open to having a check mark if they've done work for the agency before?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I don't see any problem with that.
And I don't either.
Okay. Thank you.
One comment. I think there's some amendments, Madam Chair, and I just saw them for the first time, and I think they're largely technical in nature, except to also add in forest properties as well. I don't have any problem with that. I don't think my committee would have had any problem with that. It's just, again, it's trying to get away from the dueling scientist deal, or you just pick, you know, keep shopping to get the, and just whether you're a neighbor or an applicant, they're members in good standing of the American Registry of Certified Professionals in Agronomy, Crops, and Soils, or on the other hand, there's some other name for the forestry guys, certified by the Society of American Foresters, and a member in good standing with the Association of Consulting Foresters of America.
Well, I'm going to have the department come up and just talk about the amendment. So, great. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so Michael Morrissey is here. And then actually the Department of Forestry as well. I might as well have you both come up.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, I'm Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and Catherine Daniels is with me. She's a forest specialist.
It must be that microphone.
I know. I'm not sure. We'll speak to the 2761 and the -2 amendments. So as the bill came out of the House side, it did not include forestry provisions. It was solely targeted to analysis of agricultural soils. But when you look at situations where a landowner wants to essentially challenge the soils or the forest productivity of their land because they want to rezone, they want to otherwise develop or parcelize their property, then this currently is happening about 100 times a year throughout the state, and that's what our fiscal was based on, by the way. So as you've already heard, this is an attempt to just make this process clearer, more neutral, and more technically credible by coming up with this registry that We have contacted, by the way, the professional groups that would participate in this process, and we've heard positive comments from them. We've also had, in crafting this, participation from staff at the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Forestry and the censuses. This would really be a tighter, more credible way to take on these roughly 100 situations a year. Right now, when an individual wants to go through this process, they go hire the scientist, and they go straight to the county, and the county doesn't necessarily right now have the capacity to review these reports and reach a really understandable decision. The Dash 2 amendments, as we said, does two things. It brings in the ability to analyze either forest soils or forest productivity in terms of growing trees, and it also makes clear that this bill becomes effective when DAS helps us work out a price agreement that allows us to go out and have a relationship with the people who will be providing these reports. Roughly, to the best of our knowledge, the reports cost about, on average, $5,000 a piece, and we're hearing actually now a little bit less possibly, so our fiscal is predicated on us receiving the money from the landowner, turning right around and paying the person who's producing that report and a very small amount of administrative staff to enable us to do that process.
Okay. Senator Boquist, and then we'll hear from the Department of Forestry.
Why don't we hear from Forestry first?
Okay.
But
go ahead.
Questions easy.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm David Mormon. I'm the director of the Forest Resources Planning Program at the Department of Forestry, and we're just very pleased to have the forestry provisions added to the amendment language for this bill. This bill was a great idea that came out of conversations with the Department of Agriculture and Land Conservation and Development, and early in the legislative session we were approached to see if we wanted forestry provisions added to the bill, and a lot of discussions have gone between our agencies and with stakeholders and with some of the professional societies referenced in the bill on this, and we're pleased with the amendment language that's being put forward and look forward to working with the departments and the committee as we hopefully finalize language on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess two questions. One is on the process. It would seem like it would be almost as easy to have LCDC produce a list of acceptable contractors and then have the landowner get a test acceptable from one of the contractors you're talking about. That's my first question. And the second question, I'm not familiar enough with the program of what's being done now, but it appears that this is a one-way street. This is where people are trying to get land determined to be or in an agricultural program or in a forestry program. What about the reverse and the opposite direction where, you know, they got land that doesn't want to grow trees and doesn't want to grow crops, but yet it's forestry or ag land? So, Jill, whoever wants to take that.
Go ahead. Well, so for the first part, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Boquist, I believe that the perception is right now there's a certain, in fact, we even have heard from some of the professionals who are doing this work now, to have the landowner go directly to the soil scientist and then produce this report that then goes back to the landowner and to the county just does create a certain amount of perception and tension, I guess. And from what I've heard from the departments and from other people, the process whereby the request and the money would come through the department, that most people seem to believe that would be just a little more credible with less potential bias in it. And as for the second question, I'm not really sure I kind of got the gist of that. You're right. This is for those situations where people who are currently on resource land and they want that land to be classified in a different way so that they can develop it in some fashion. So
a follow-up question. I think what you just said is that they want to change, as the byline says, allows landowner to request independent soil capacity assessment. But when I read Section 2, it says if a landowner wants to determine whether land qualifies as agricultural land, it appears to me that the language of both this and the Dash 1 amendment is one way. Landowner concludes the county land qualifies. You follow my
train of thought here.
So right now, there, Senator Boquist, Chair Denfelder, there is information that is currently available for landowners in the county to use. That information typically has been generated by the National
Research and Conservation Service.
Where that isn't available, then the landowner has to take some extra steps to somehow challenge that, and this is the process whereby they do that.
We're not moving this bill today, so we can do some follow-up.
All right.
Okay, any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. We have three other people who'd like to testify on this. Jim Just, Danielle Williver, and Mickey Killingsworth. Hey, Mr. Chess, why don't you get started? You signed up first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Just. I'm Executive Director of the Goal One Coalition. We have been involved in these issues for many years, and they have been the cause of much litigation. This would provide an objective and scientific process and eliminate much of the grounds for dissension and the cause of litigation, and we fully support the bill and the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay, thank you. Danielle?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Welliver. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for Thousand Friends of Oregon. Thousand Friends of Oregon does support this bill. We believe this bill will assure that objective, qualified soil scientists will be used to classify agricultural land, and then from that, those qualified scientists will help restore confidence in Oregon's land use system and ensure that land use standards are applied correctly. And we understand that there are some amendments, and we do support those as well. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
For the record, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Mickey Killingsworth. I'm Secretary Treasurer of Jefferson County Farm Bureau, and I'm testifying on their behalf. And I'm from Central Oregon. We support this bill. And to correct the gentleman from the forestry, this did not come from Department of Ag. This came from a work group that Representative Clem put together this past summer, and I was a member of that work group. And it was the farmers who brought this up and kept saying, you know, we need science. Everybody asked us to deal with PERS. Everybody asked us to deal with this and this and that. We'd like to have some objective science when we go before local land use hearing processes, so we can, you know, we deal with science every day in agriculture. So that was where this actually came from, Senator Boquist.
Okay.
And our County Farm Bureau is in support of it, even with the supposedly amendments.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we have a work group member here now that can explain it to us, can you just expand on your testimony? I mean, obviously, American Registry of Certified Professionals, agronomy, so on and so forth, what we're trying to do is, I guess, legitimize that so that it's the department asking them to do the soil samples, and are we trying to put confirmed soils are in or soils are out? Is it both directions? What was discussed in the work group?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Boquist. In the work group, it was to go both ways. It was so there was a credible scientific person doing the research and preparing the report. And it didn't. And part of it was consumer protection, because some people have hired scientists, or maybe not scientists. They weren't registered. They were just people that say, we have these qualifications. Then somebody else spends another $5,000, and they come in, they get in, as you say, the dueling reports. And then somebody will say, well, this person has all the education and all the certificates. They know what they're doing. This other person, you know, just makes their living in this other way. So that was the basis of the conversation when we did this in the work group is, okay, so where is this? So we did go to Department of Ag, and we did ask Jim Johnson, who does this? Where he was the technical staff person for the work group. And he came forth, and he said, well, this is the agency that certifies, and he gave us all that information. So the work group farmers said, that makes sense to us. There has to be somebody out there, you know, and if they're certified and registered, check it off, and qualified, then they should be recognized in the system as where you go to get some somebody to do it. And then the next component came up, well, do we want people just to go out and get somebody, or do we want it ran through the state of Oregon? And we talked about if it's ran through the state of Oregon, as long as it's a cost rotating, the state of Oregon's not making money off of it, but as long as it's a true thing where they pick the scientists that are available, so you're not waiting in line, and they have a credibility, maybe that's the way to do it. So those are the concepts that were put in the bill that came from the work group, from the farmers. And it was really meant to go both ways. Whenever there was a conflict, you know, about soils, this is what was meant from the work group.
And can you just say who is in that work group?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Boquist. Department Ag had a representative, Jim Johnson. DLCD had Michael Morrissey, who was up here, and Catherine Daniels, who was up here. Thousand Friends had Kate Kimball, myself, Gary Harris, Peter Kanagi, Bruce Chapin, Richard Holcomb from Southern Oregon. I may be forgetting somebody, but that's pretty much off the top of my head, and Representative Clem and staff.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions? Gordon needs witnesses. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. So we don't have the paperwork on this bill either because of the amendment, so we will go ahead and close the public hearing. But is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2761?
Chair, but before you drop the gavel, I would like to get Department of Forestry to come talk to me, because in reading the Department of Forestry, the amendment, the Department of Forestry side goes much farther than soil samples.
Okay. I will make sure that they're shaking their head that they'll come visit with you on that. And this does have a fiscal, so it will have to go to Ways and Means regardless, by the way.
Right, Madam Chair, and I would think if you're adding the Department of Forestry to this, it's going to get, the fiscal's going to change significantly.
I would agree.
In looking for the record here, having experienced this myself, owning forest lands, their analysis is based on tree measurements, and on any given day I can hire three certified foresters from the Society of American Foresters and come up with three different opinions.
That's how it is sometimes in science. All right. So if the Department of Forestry could follow up with Senator Boquist, appreciate that. And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2761. And next we are going back to water, it sounds like. We are going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3123. And I saw Representative Bailey, and then he left. Here he is. Boy, good ears. We wanted to introduce the bill. Welcome back, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Copel Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42, Inner East Side, Portland. House Bill 3123 is a simple bill. What it does is corrects asks DEQ to study the best way to correct what is a missing link in the West Coast in terms of how we protect our oceans and how we protect our citizens. Currently, Oregon is the missing link in a chain of states from California up to Alaska that has regulations on how passenger vessels, specifically cruise ships, are able to dump sewage and hazardous material into our territorial waters. Now, Oregon has to apply under the Clean Water Act for the ability to regulate this kind of dumping from passenger vessels, and the original bill, as written, would have had a significant fiscal cost to DEQ. So rather than set up a situation where we were going to be asking for additional dollars from an already scarce general fund, and to ensure that Oregon's regulations end up mirroring states to the north and south so that there is a consistent framework of regulation up the West Coast, we have worked with DEQ and with the ports to develop this language to ask DEQ to engage in this study, to come up with recommendations, and to come back in the next legislative session so we can act on their recommendations and ensure that Oregon, too, is protecting its citizens and its beaches from any unwanted or unlawful dumping.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Any questions? Okay, I actually have one. I do know that the department, DEQ is here, but I don't know if they were going to speak on this. So do we, I'm assuming we only have jurisdiction within the territorial sea as far as DEQ's authority.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's my understanding.
Okay. I see DEQ shaking their head back there. So they would just be studying within the impacts within the territorial sea.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And if I might add, on the in the Oregonian today, you may have seen an article about the big business that cruise ships are now bringing to Oregon's coast. And we're very glad that that is a source of economic development for our coastal communities. And it is not the intention of this bill, and we want to be very careful to ensure that we are not shifting that business elsewhere along the West Coast. We believe that that is a valuable source of economic development to these communities, and that's why we want to proceed carefully, but we do want to make sure that we do have consistent regulation and that we're protecting these coastal communities at the same time.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Hold on, Senator Boquist. You're not off that easy.
Madam Chair, I'm just, it might be a comment more than a question. Because I recall we just did a DEQ bill regarding bilge water, correct? And I'm assuming that would kind of, for better word, flow together. program that they're looking to research and expand in the future. But the two of them would kind of go together, I'm assuming.
Well, we'll have the department up here. I know they're here to answer any questions. So we'll hear from the remaining witnesses, and then we'll call them up.
And Madam Chair, my understanding is that the Port of Astoria also has a representative here in case there are questions about how this directly relates to ports.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And so I will call up Ken Armstrong is here with the Ports Association in the Port of Astoria.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Public Ports Association, Oregon's 23 public port districts. And I also have with me Bruce Connor from the Port of Astoria. Mr. Connor has a considerable background in the cruise ship industry and is doing marketing for the Port of Astoria. Astoria is where we see virtually all of the cruise ship activity for Oregon. As Representative Bailey mentioned in today's article, we're seeing an increased amount of activity as a result of the redirection of some cruise ships from Mexico and elsewhere coming to the Columbia River. We have appreciated Representative Bailey's working with us on this. Of course, our first concern was, we actually had two first concerns. One, we want to be sure, of course, that whatever we're doing as an industry and the industries that we're working with, such as the cruise ship industry, is doing so in the most environmentally safe and sound manner possible, and at the same time, not having a chilling effect on this industry that is vital to Astoria and to the rest of the state. Our conversations with Representative Bailey and with DEQ, I think, have been extremely productive. We're here in a neutral capacity to provide you with any information that you may want or need on the cruise ship industry. This is a very clean industry. It's one that utilizes exceptional technology. The impact is extremely low, and I think that the engrossed version of this bill, what DEQ comes back with, is going to bolster that. And so, consequently, we've got no problem with the bill as in front of you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, and Mr. Connor's here in that same capacity.
Okay. Mr. Connor, would you like to add anything?
Oh, I would actually agree certainly with what Ken had to say. We've contacted the cruise industry.
Can you just state your name, please? Yeah.
Pardon me?
Can you just state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, Bruce Connor, Madam Chair, Senators. Bruce Connor, Port of Astoria, Marketing Director. I would add that the we had had this discussion with several of the cruise line representatives, and all of them have invited anyone or DEQ to come on down and to the ships. As a matter of fact, we set up a date the 22nd of September. I would use the word they were overjoyed with this bill in that they are excited to show off what they do and how clean they are.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Senator Atkinson.
How far out do cruise ships go off the coast?
Typically, the shipping lanes are well beyond the 3 miles. Typically, it'll range depending the distance, but between 30 and 50 miles, they will pass the Oregon shores.
So they never get within the territorial boundary?
Only when they come into the Columbia River. And that's the 3 mile. And the cruise ships, what they do, they far exceed all restrictions. They if they any ballast water, they'll ballast 12 miles out, as opposed to the they're required to do it at least 3 miles out. But just to make them very 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 cautious, they'll do it 12 miles out.
Okay. Any questions? Any other questions? No. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. And we have the department here. Would you like to have the department come up, Senator Boquist, and address your coordination issue?
Well, Madam Chair, not particularly. I'm looking at this, and if they are doing this 12 miles off the coast and we're studying it, I'm not. All right.
Well, why don't we have the department come up? And anybody else that would like to testify in this bill that did not sign up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christine Spekiewicz with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, yes, we will be coordinating internally very well related to all of the bills that passed this legislative session.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Is there
start something here?
You're right. No, really, no. I would agree with that, but because there's not much money or if any money attached to this, but I guess my question is, we're focusing on passenger ships. Are we just, is this really just a study to check and make sure they're doing what's right since we don't really have them and they only come to the Port of Astoria, or is there a perceived problem? Or?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, there is a perceived problem, not from DEQ's perspective, but we've never studied this before. And so this bill provides us the opportunity to look in depthly of what really does go on related to cruise ships in Oregon's waters.
So I guess you'll come back and tell us next session.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Is there a fiscal?
Minimal.
There's a minimal fiscal impact. There's no statement issued.
Do we know what minimal means?
I can ask.
Well, the department, I'm sure, can tell us.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, the minimal fiscal is approximately $20,000 for us during the next biennium. We estimate it'll take about 2 months of work to do the research and develop the legislative report.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I asked that question because three of us heard earlier a minimum fiscal, and then when I got the what the minimum fiscal defined at, it didn't meet the definition that we generally use in the President's office. So.
No, I appreciate you asking that. It's important. Okay, any other questions for the department? All right. Thank you very much. And we have no amendments to this, so I will close the public hearing and work session. Okay. Open up a work session on House Bill 3123A, and we'll take a motion. You make a motion?
Right. Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 3123A be reported out of committee with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves that House Bill 3123A. Be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. And Senator Haas, I think you've been our guy out in the doing a lot of
invasive
species and ballast water.
Ballast.
So you're a cruise guy. All right. So with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3123A. And I think we have one more public hearing. Is that right? We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3417A.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3417A modifies the definition of a stray animal to mean cattle or equines that are unlawfully running at large or being permitted to do so, or that are found to be trespassing on land enclosed by an adequate fence.
Okay. And we have... does the department want to come up?
Yeah.
Is Representative Huffman here? Don't see him. Okay, so Jim Welch and Roger Beyer. You're going to explain to us what a stray animal.
Buffaloes and large again?
Yeah, I was going to say, this is, we want to know.
Madam Chair and committee members, Jim Welch, representing the Oregon Cattlemen Association. And this is our bill. We did ask to have this written, and it's after 2 years of lengthy work on this particular issue. This is a fee bill. There's no doubt about it. It's a fee increase because it's a possible.
Period.
Well, let's say it gives a State Department an opportunity to assess a fee if they so desire in a location in statute which they do not have that ability today, and that would be in ORS 607-300. But we, in 2007, we being the Oregon Cattlemen Association, came to you and asked for a fee increase. The Brand Department, which is a cattleman's and a livestock program, is administered by the State Department of Agriculture, and it is paid entirely by fees. And those fees are established when there is a sale of an animal and there's an inspection of that particular cow or even a horse, and that has to occur before sale or movement across borders, across state lines. And so when that does occur, there is a $1 fee today, which back before 2007 was 60 cents. And to keep the program viable, we had to look at increasing that particular fee. That's why we came to you in 2007. We set a cap at $1, and in about a year, we were at that cap. There were some extenuating circumstances that increased that, and wages was one. But the other is addressed in this bill. There was increased estray horses, and estray means that particular animal is out on properties being reported as a stray animal, and the Department of Agriculture Brand Department has to go out and take up that particular animal and find the owner. And that they can recover in statute compensation through that process. If they can't find the owner of that particular animal, then that animal is put out for sale. And through that sale, they can recover some of their expenses. But if a cow gets out, a horse gets out, they assume there's a broken fence. So wherever there's a possible breakthrough, they find the owner, they go and examine those fence lines. And that is a non-compensable action. And that's what we want to establish in this bill also, that they can establish a fee for that particular service. And sometimes that particular fence line is between two livestock owners, and there becomes a disagreement on who's responsible or whose cow broke it down, and they have to mitigate all that. And so that was never a compensable action either. So this allows that. And so we are asking, the other issue in this is, of course, we are eliminating some other livestock because they do not pay into the program. And some of those livestock would be sheep and goats. Today, they are spending their time, the highest number of livestock they spend time on is cattle. Second is goats. And third is horses. They've been spending a lot of time on horses because people have been dumping horses. And so that increases. But goats is up there, too, and that kind of surprised me. But they do not pay into the program. They do not have an inspection, no way for them to pay into, and nobody has said they wanted to. This is a particular floor letter. It's not my regular testimony letter, but it gives you all the bullet points and explanation. We asked, went out to the Farm Bureau and the dairy farmers and sheep growers and asked if there's any opposition, and we didn't find any unless we hear some today. So it passed out of House Committee and passed on the floor. 57-3 were opposed to it because it was a fee bill and they had a problem with voting for a fee bill. So.
And the reason that we're seeing a lot of horses is that because of the recession right now? Unfortunate. Roger, you want to go, and then we'll take any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. The Oregon Dairy Farmers are the second largest user of the brand program. Dairy cows rarely escape and get through broken down fences, but because that is a cost driver to the department, it has caused them to raise fees on the brand inspection program, which dairy farmers are required to be in. So if this bill will help keep fees down in the brand program, the dairy farmers will support it. I'd just like to put on the record that there's talks in the Dairy Association about in the future looking to get dairy cows out of being part of the brand program, because most dairy cattle are no longer branded. They are marked with ear tags or something else. So for the future, Madam Chair, members of the committee, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think Senator Boquist has one.
Yes, Madam Chair. Mr. Beyer, former Senator Beyer, right? You're former Senator Beyer, right?
I'm sure he's happy he's not on the side of the dais right now.
You're in favor of the fee increase.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, everyone is always in favor of a fee increase when someone else pays the fees. And because the dairy farmers rarely, if ever, use this service, then of course the dairy farmers would be happy to have someone else paying the fees so their fees on the brand inspection would stay cheaper.
I think that was an affirmative.
I think that was a good tap dance for a lobbyist, a former senator.
Yeah, right. Okay, any other questions for either of these gentlemen? Yeah.
One question again, in case somebody comes back. Jim made mention that the second highest was goats, and they're not part of the program. And if they're eliminated from the program and the goats are now at large, who's going to deal with the goats at large?
Feral goats.
Pigs.
Or send them together.
I'm just wondering if we're going to have the next session complaints on that.
Feral goat bill? Oh.
We'll have to see. I think that the county will be connected with sheriff's department, or if certain counties have an animal, what do they call it, program, and they can Tri counties and Deschutes counties. We have had humane special officers that have done this in the past, but and they probably would for goats. But I've talked to them through this particular issue, and they're much more interested in cats and dogs and a few of those animals than these that are farm animals.
Leave the department here. Do you want them to come up?
I'm just wondering who the department's going to say call when they call them for goats.
Why don't you come up, Lisa? I don't think we'll be able to sleep this weekend if we don't know the answer to the goat question. Yeah.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. You are correct, and this clearly removes the responsibility from ODA for these other livestock, sheep and goats.
For goats, right.
And with that, my understanding is it becomes an issue of those individuals that have acquired the animal in their yard, et cetera, to dispose of them or to find the owner or to call animal control or some other means. As the recipient of one of those goats in my local neighborhood, previously using the Estray program, it becomes a challenge.
Yeah. Yes, we're anticipating the feral goat bill next session. Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Przonski.
I think I'll start a business and just have the phone number Goat Buster.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, it really is Friday afternoon. Any other questions?
Make it stop, Madam.
Okay, I can do that. You can help me. Anybody else like to testify on this bill?
No goat bill.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3417A, and I will open up a work session on House Bill 3417A.
Madam Chair, with all the regret of a Friday afternoon, I would move House Bill 3417A forward with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves that House Bill 3417A go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll be a yes vote as long as I don't have to carry it.
Okay, I have a carrier.
Okay.
No,
for
I
this Estray bill.
I don't think you do anymore.
We have a carrier for this Estray bill. Any other comments?
I will make fun of Senator Beyer as I carry this bill.
That's fine with all of us. Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries and Senator Atkinson gets this Estray bill.
The Senator Beyer, yes.
And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3417, and we have one final work session, House Bill 2080A. Beth?
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, you heard this bill on May 5th. House Bill 2080A encourages appropriate reuse of gray water for beneficial uses, defines gray water as wastewater from baths, showers, bathroom, and kitchen sinks and laundries, directs the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules for gray water reuse and disposal system permits, declares emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact on fiscal stabilization.
Okay. And colleagues, I'll ask the department to come up and just clarify. We want to make sure that an issue that was raised in the House would be addressed through rulemaking. That's why we wanted to meet with the department.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Neil Mullane. I'm the Administrator of the Water Division at DEQ. And as you know, we've been working on this bill in interim session and during session, and we believe the amendments as stated today can be supported by the department.
Well, we don't have any amendments. Amended in the House. Right. So we would just wanted to clarify, though, that the rulemaking would cover issues that were discussed on definitions for fecal matter and other areas of concern, and make sure that that was addressed through the rulemaking that you intend to do.
Madam Chair, yes. As we put together the advisory committee would look at each of those waste streams that are in the bill and the gray water definitions, and they would develop either treatment mechanisms depending on what is in the wastewater or management practices for the actual distribution of that water when it leaves the structure. And it would be our intent to utilize the definitions as in the bill and develop those, the regulatory practices for the rules and the permit to take those into consideration.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any questions for the department? All right, thank you. And we are in work session, so I will entertain a motion.
I'd move House Bill 2080 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2080A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I own substantial stock in a company that already has FDA-approved systems for the conversion of gray water, and I could potentially profit from this in the state of Oregon.
Okay, potential conflict so noted. Any other comments? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries, and I will carry the bill since I'm sure nobody else wants to talk about this issue. And with that, we will close the work session for House Bill 2080A and close the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee.